This episode is brought to you by Odmo's Pizza in Cambie. Handmade awesome pizza plus craft beer, wine, and cider. Delivered. Call them today at 503-263-8444.
Welcome to Now Hear This, Cambie,
your source for news.
The threat of a possible teacher strike was avoided this week.
There's a new irresistibly cute creature winning over fans, and its name is Scootaloo.
Sports?
It's like Lucy in the football. You want to kick a field goal, but they take it away from you.
We had to learn how to win.
Goal can't be in the last second of the game!
And interesting conversations.
Because I'm one of the strongest girls ever, and I know that for a fact.
I just really enjoy writing gossip as if I was a bear.
With an old maid daughter that make the best moonshine in the coast.
If it would have hit me in the face, I think I would have died. I really do.
I guarantee you would have died, man. Are you kidding me?
Welcome to the Now Hear This, Cambie podcast. Thanks for listening. I'm Martina Baker, and this is what's happening this week in our community. Cambie Republican Christine Drazen announced Friday that she will resign the seat she has held for more than 3 years in the State House of Representatives, freeing her up to focus on the 2022 race for governor, in which she has quickly emerged as the likely GOP frontrunner. The decision makes her the third gubernatorial candidate and first Republican to leave the legislature to focus on the campaign. Drazen's last day will be Monday, January 31st, the day before the legislature begins its 35-day February session. Resigning frees her to campaign and raise money, as House rules bar legislatures from fundraising during session. Friday was the final day in office for House Speaker Tina Kotek. The Portland Democrat and long-serving speaker in Oregon history announced her resignation earlier this month. She, too, is running for governor. And on Friday afternoon, Oregon Supreme Court Chief Justice Martha Walters swore in former legislative staffer Rachel Armitage to fill the Senate seat left vacant when moderate Democrat Betsy Johnson resigned in December to focus on her independent gubernatorial campaign. Drazen was the House Republican leader from 2019 until she announced her campaign last November. In a statement announcing her resignation, she said she was disillusioned by the political atmosphere in Salem. I found a broken political system where people serve their own interest and advance short-sighted bumper sticker policies, she said. I found abusive, entitled power brokers shamefully casual about the impacts their decision had on people's lives. I found gamesmanship that would turn your stomach. She previously worked as chief of staff for former Republican House Speaker Mark Simmons and as a political coordinator for the Oregon Restaurant and Lodging Association, one of the state's most powerful business lobbies. While Republican leader, she led her caucus out of state in February 2020 to deny House Democrats the quorum they needed to pass legislation aimed at reducing carbon emissions. She also spearheaded efforts to deny quorum last year after Kotek reneged on a deal to give Republicans an equal say in drawing new legislative and congressional maps. Republican precinct committee members in Clackamas and Marion counties will nominate 3 to 5 candidates for Drazen's seat, and county commissioners will pick one to serve until the end of Drazen's term in January 2023. Those same aforementioned reapportionment efforts have changed the boundaries and numbering of Cambie's House and Senate districts, though less drastically for the former. The new House District 51, which will take effect when the new representative is sworn in next January, largely resembles the current District 39, with the biggest changes being an eastward slide that includes the communities of Sandy and Estacada and a larger chunk of eastern Clackamas County, while excluding more of the county's urban northwest. Drazen now leads the gubernatorial Republican primary field in fundraising, with about $640,000 in available cash and nearly $800,000 raised in total since early 2021. Her closest competition in the race comes from Lake Oswego political consultant Bridget Barton, who raised $540,000 and has $372,000 available. Sandy Mayer, Stan Pulliam, who raised $750,000 and has $250,000 left, and Salem oncologist Bud Pierce, who self-funded more than a third of his $850,000 haul and has $150,000 left to spend. Oregon's short-term COVID-19 outlook remains bleak. Oregon's lead epidemiologist said Friday, with hospitals nearing a peak in the demand for hospital beds and case counts skyrocketing. But after that, the situation could improve, according to Dr. Dean Seidlinger, the state epidemiologist. The Omicron variant continues to cut a destructive swath through Oregon, fueling steadily rising hospitalizations, record-shattering daily cases, and a staggering test positivity rate, Seidlinger said in an online news conference. There is some light at the end of this very dark tunnel. The recent modeling suggests that cases could peak within the next week or so, and hospitalizations, a lagging indicator, peaking in the following week. Seidlinger is basing his outlook on projections by Peter Graven, assistant professor at Oregon Health and Science University, who released his latest forecast on Thursday. Graven expects a peak of about 1,550 people hospitalized for COVID on February 1st. If the subsequent trend in Oregon follows those in East Coast states, where Omicron hit earlier, hospitalizations would then fall rapidly. Graven's forecast shows Omicron hospitalizations dropping to about 300 people by the end of February, which compares with the numbers in early August before the Delta surge, or in late December before the rise in Omicron hospitalizations. In the meantime, Seidlinger indicated that the Oregon Health Authority intends to forge ahead with making permanent the indoor mask requirement that was put in place on a temporary basis November 23rd and would expire February 9th without new state action. Seidlinger said the state will rescind the rule when conditions improve, repeating a message from Patrick Allen, director of the Oregon Health Authority, last week in testimony to a legislative committee. Because it's a permanent rule does not mean it will be here forever, Seidlinger said. Republican leaders in the Oregon House have called for the health authority to set benchmarks that would determine when the rule would be lifted, and they called on supporters to speak out during a public comment period. The Associated Press reported 350 people participated in the state hearing opposing the rule. Seidlinger said the state will take comments made at Thursday's hearing into consideration. He said state officials didn't intend to set benchmarks to trigger removal of the mask mandate, indicating that there are too many variables and unknowns. State health officials will consider hospital capacity, the availability of COVID-19 treatments, which are currently in short supply, and how well the vaccines hold up against the virus before deciding to lift the rule, Seidlinger said. Like its mask policy, the Oregon Health Authority plans no changes in testing. The latest test positivity rate, which does not include results from most at-home tests, was 22% the week of January 9th to January 15th, the state data shows. That compares with more than 7% the week of December 19th to December 25th, and nearly 16% from December 26th to January 1st. Oregon has purchased 6 million rapid test kits, which each has two tests, and received 1.9 million to date. It has distributed 110,000 kits to K-12 schools, nearly 800,000 to hospitals, and 260,000 to local health clinics that mainly serve low-income residents. Seidlinger said the state has 500,000 kits in reserve to replenish supplies for schools and hospitals. The state expects another 600,000 kits to arrive in the coming days. The state does not plan to follow Washington state lead and offer them to Oregonians online. Deception, Disguise, and Misadventure took center stage at the Canby Fine Arts Center this weekend as Canby High School Theater debuted its production of The Importance of Being Earnest, Oscar Wilde's classic tale of mistaken identity, lies, the English class system, and the never-ending vanity and selfishness of high society. There were several reasons for the student board's selection of this 19th century masterpiece. First, with the uncertainty surrounding school and extracurricular activities due to the ongoing COVID pandemic, not to mention the school's position of drama advisor, which remained unfilled until recently, it was just easier and cheaper to select a work comfortably ensconced in the public domain. More significantly, though, Ernest has long been a mainstay of the reading list for students in CHS's BritLit, British Literature, class, and senior Bryn Spoon, who plays Cecily and also serves as treasury for the Canby Thespians, said she has always appreciated the play's wit and humor. Shows can cost a lot of money, depending on what you do, so we were looking for something affordable and fun that people would care about, Spoon explained. But I remember sitting in class and reading this play, and I actually read for the character that I play now, and I was like, this show is so funny. I like this. The comedic farce, which Wilde wrote at the height of his fame and popularity, tells the story of two bachelors who both create alter egos named Ernest to escape their tiresome lives. At the same time, they are each attempting to win the hearts of two women who, conveniently, have vowed to only fall in love with a man named Ernest. Hilarity ensues as the two get hopelessly entangled in their own deceptions and mistruths. The production's new advisor and director, Sullivan McIntosh, came on board shortly before Thanksgiving break and hit the ground running, but has still made for a compressed timeline in preparing the show. Because of that altered timeline with our new director, we started way later than usual, Spoon explained. It's been a really packed production. Though it was written well over a century ago, Spoon and the other cast and crew members see a number of parallels to our current times, as well as themes that continue to ring true about people and society. Senior Connor Morris, the show's student technical director and props master, says the idea of wielding different personas in different arenas of life rings particularly true for many teens. It's very real, you know, he said. Everybody has their own home life and their school life and their work life. Everyone is typically quiet or on their own, and we put on this front for show. You can definitely see the parallels between art and life. Catch Canby High School's The Importance of Being Earnest at 7 p.m. January 27th, 28th, and 29th with a 2 p.m. matinee on Saturday. Cougar Country hometown sports coverage is brought to you by Rife and Hunsaker PC. When you need an attorney, turn to the firm Canby has trusted for over 50 years. Call them today at 503-266-3456. For the latest sports news, follow us on Twitter at Cougar Country OR and Instagram at Cougar Country POD. On Tuesday night, the Canby boys basketball team led Lake Oswego 47-46 with 5:45 minutes remaining in the game. Unfortunately, a slew of turnovers and missed shots culminated in a 15-point Laker win. The tough loss marked the beginning of Three Rivers League play for the Cougars. Rather than be discouraged, Canby flipped the script in their second league tilt with Lake Ridge 2 days later, staging a comeback effort of their own and storming back from an early deficit to down the Pacers in convincing fashion 65-44. Tuesday's road matchup against the Lakers was the Cougs' first game in almost 2 weeks after their original TRL debut against Tualatin was postponed due to COVID. The game also marked the return of star point guard Alex Evans, who had missed the previous 3 games due to an injury. Evans came off of the bench for the first time in 30 games for the Cougars and made his impact immediately known by burying a three. He would finish the game with 8 points, 5 rebounds, and 3 assists in limited action for Canby. Meanwhile, high-flying senior wing Peyton Myers continued what has always been his number one priority for the Cougars, getting buckets. Myers scored 20 points on the night, most of which came in the first 3 quarters. But after taking the 1-point lead with just under 6 minutes left, the Cougars went ice cold, hitting only one more basket. A Myers triple with 7 seconds left, and the game well out of reach. Lake Oswego had outscored Canby 19-3 over the final 5 minutes and 25-9 in the fourth quarter. 2 days later, Canby found themselves in a similar situation, this time at home against Lake Ridge. After falling down by 7 points in the first quarter, Canby used a balanced attack to inch back to within 1 at halftime. The game remained close before the Cougs gained their first lead of the game, 35-34, with 2 minutes and 30 seconds remaining in the third. From that point on, the boys never looked back. The Cougars outscored the Pacers 27-10 in the final frame to take home a commanding 21-point win. Myers dumped in 25 points, including an absurd 21 in the fourth quarter alone, including a spectacular alley-oop teed up by Evans. Evans didn't hit a field goal in the game, but still finished with 4 points, 5 rebounds, and 6 assists. Senior big Jacob Strand finished with 12 points and 7 rebounds. Next up for Canby is a daunting home matchup against University of Oregon commit Jackson Schellstad and the 9-1 West Lynn Lions. Tip-off is scheduled for 3 p.m.
Are you a healthcare hero? Do you want to become one? Are you looking for a position where you are valued, your time is your own, and you have ample opportunity for growth? Marquee companies at Hope Village in Canby, Oregon offers all of that and more. They are currently hiring nurses, caregivers, CNAs, and enrolling students in their free CNA course. From competitive wages and up to $25,000 tuition reimbursement to flexible schedules and the opportunity to make a positive impact on someone's life, Marquee at Hope Village is the right place for you. Take your career to the next level and apply now to become a valued team member at Marquee at Hope Village in Canby. To learn more or apply today, text CURRENT, that's C-U-R-R-E-N-T, to 888-906-3432.
Hey, Frankie, what are you doing?
I'm trying to figure out which TV option I want to use when DirectLink turns off their video services in January of next year. It's so confusing. Do you know there's about 48 million streaming services to choose from? Which devices do they work on? What channels do they offer?
No, I did not know that. But you do realize that you're probably better off than you think. If you have DirectLink's Easy Video TV now, you're already using a streaming service. But listen, you don't have to go this alone. DirectLink is actually helping their members transition to their next video provider. The company has an extensive informational website where you can compare popular services, and they host live tutorials on streaming TV options to help you decide.
Well, hold the phone. Are you saying that they're actively trying to help their members switch to a competing service? Who does that?
Well, DirectLink does. I mean, I guess it's one more chapter in their long history of wanting the best for our community. They've actually offered free classes for the past 12 years that teach our neighbors about the latest technology and internet security practices. And don't forget, they also orchestrated that popular bingo game last year that helped keep everyone entertained and connected during the lockdowns. They've also launched special programs to help keep our students connected at home during the pandemic, and partnered with the city of Canby to give free Wi-Fi year-round at 3 local parks for locals and visitors alike.
Wait, DirectLink does all that?
They do indeed, and that's on top of providing the best and most reliable internet and voice services in town. So, to learn more about DirectLink services or how they can help you transition to the right video service for your home, visit directlink.coop today.
Lovely. Well, that sound, of course, means that we are once again down at Canby Music Store on a gorgeous January afternoon with the owner, Brian Haynes. Hi, Brian.
Hello.
And we're introducing a couple of new/newish employees, members of the team.
Yes, we have Lana and Christian that both teach lessons here at the store.
Hi, Lana and Christian. Welcome.
Hi.
Hello.
How are you guys doing?
Oh, pretty good.
Yeah,
no, beautiful day.
Exciting.
So, Christian, we're going to start with you. You're a little bit of the slightly more veteran member, right? You joined the team last summer, I believe.
Yeah, beginning of May, right before my birthday. I think that's part of why the reason Brian let me come on board was because I just turned 18. So
well, there you go. Yeah.
Yeah. So I teach all the strings kind of stuff. My background is violin. Stuff that was my first instrument was violin, and then I started branching off, and guitar was my next, and then just kind of from there it just spiraled out. Especially when I started working here, picked up bass, drums, that kind of stuff, sticking more to
that classic string and instrument, drums.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, stuff like that. Oh, and piano. I do piano a little bit.
Which is considered a string, right? Because it has
It's
strings?
Actually, I'm pretty sure it's a percussion instrument,
okay.
isn't it?
Okay, gotcha. Yeah, it hits the strings. Yeah,
yeah, exactly.
The little hammers inside there.
Yeah.
How did you start with violin? That feels so intimidating to be like somebody's first instrument, right?
Yeah, a lot of people, I guess on a lot of lists, it's considered one of the hardest instruments to play.
Yeah.
At least to learn.
Yeah.
So I started when I was five. Probably too young to start learning.
Were you
but,
like even as big as a violin? Like,
yeah, it's those quarter-sized violins that are, you know, like as big as my forearm.
It's like made now. By Fisher-Price.
Something like that. So I went to this small private school called Two Rivers Farm School, actually in Aurora, technically. I think it might even be in Hubbard, but it's on Meridian Road. Mm-hmm. And we, part of the requirements for that school was to play an instrument. Mm-hmm. And so the three choices were violin, cello, and harp.
Okay.
So,
see,
I just
farm school, I would think like it'd be banjo.
Yeah, that's
fiddle,
a good point.
Banjo.
Yeah, I guess it's fiddle, cello, fiddle. Yeah. Anyways, so
no, very classical,
very classically trained.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, for I guess the first like 10 years of my life, I only played classical music over and over again for that many years, and it got very stale. Mm-hmm. So after I graduated 8th grade of that school, went on to high school at a different school in Malala High. I kind of stopped because I felt like I wasn't being forced to play it anymore.
Yeah.
I felt kind of free. But sophomore of high school, I had some friends that I'd met some friends that were in band, and they kind of talked me into joining again because they knew I played violin. And so they talked me into it. I joined the wind ensemble as a strings player. At the time, I was the only string player. And then some cellos ended up joining later. So we kind of turned it into more of like a kind of orchestra band hybrid thing.
Yeah.
So that was a lot of fun. And then I took kung fu lessons at at that place down, Balance and Harmony is what it was called, with Nick.
Oh, yeah. Okay.
And so he taught guitar, and he kind of encouraged me to play guitar with him. So, because we were pretty good friends just from, I took kung fu lessons for for 6 years. And so, anyways, he encouraged me to play that. I had started playing guitar. I bought a guitar, started playing it, and I did not like it. Mm. And so I was like, okay, never mind. Don't want to play guitar. And a year later, after my mom got mad at me for leaving my guitar for an entire year in the living room, it just sat there for a whole year. I was like,
being part of the scenery. Yeah.
Yeah, so I moved it into my room, and I picked it up, and I just kind of fiddled around with it. And I think the first chord I figured out on my own was the G chord. And so from there, I started taking lessons again.
Chord.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah, so
he was
then,
only able to leave it there that long because he kept threatening her with kung fu. He's like, karate chop you. Give me more guff about my guitar, Mom. Yeah.
So, yeah, then from there, I was working. After I graduated high school, I started working at Langdon Farms and just decided that wasn't really for me.
Yeah.
And the day after I stopped, the contractor for this building, Bill Gilmer, he told me that Brian was looking for someone. I was like, maybe you should go meet him. And I went and met him the day after, and then I got hired. So
awesome.
Here I am.
Yeah, very cool. I know a lot of the people who work here are also doing school or doing other stuff on the side. Is that true for you as well? Or?
Yeah, I'm currently going to Clackamas Community College.
Okay.
And we are, well, I am doing more of the recording aspect because that has interested me a lot, writing and recording music.
You write some of your own music?
Some of, yeah.
Awesome.
I haven't really produced anything,
but
writing
slowly.
That's
really cool. Yeah. Yeah. Is violin still your main instrument, or do you do a lot more guitar?
I would
now?
Consider it the instrument I'm still best at,
just
because I played it for so long. It's almost like an extension of me.
Sure.
But I have been playing mostly guitar recently.
Okay. Yeah.
Yeah, a lot of drums, too.
Yeah, awesome. I've seen you at least one event, kind of a life thing with Brian. Have you done some of that as well?
Yeah, just the one so far.
Okay.
I've been thinking about trying to get back into it.
Yeah.
I had my mom's been trying to push me into doing that stuff. It's not exactly my forte, but I still enjoy it. Pushes me to be better.
Yeah.
A better musician. So
yeah.
Definitely
awesome.
Interested in it.
So you're doing lessons here and starting to learn a little bit of the repair work, right? Tell me
more
about working here, what you like about it.
Yeah, I've obviously being a musician, instruments break. Mm-hmm. So
yeah,
and strings break. Yeah. I didn't know how to switch a string on my violin until I started working here,
really?
Which is interesting.
So you'd always just take it somewhere to get repaired.
Yep.
Or whatnot. Yeah.
Yeah, and I always felt guilty. I was like, I feel like I should know how to do this, and then, yeah. But Nathan taught me how to do it, and he's very good at teaching.
Yeah,
that kind of stuff.
Wizard.
Yeah, repair really? Wizard indeed.
Yeah.
Yeah. So I've started just doing various things, do string changes and setups. Started to do setups. That's fun.
Yeah.
Yeah. Fixed a bridge on a ukulele the other day.
Oh, so, awesome.
Just little things.
Yeah, picking things up. Very yeah. cool. Okay, we'll travel over to the different part of the instrument world with Lana. Very similar story. You know, your expertise in kung fu kind of led you.
I actually took taekwondo in second grade. No. Yeah, so I started in seventh grade when I was 12 at Baker Prairie.
Cool.
And I was under Nick Luchterhand, and I've been under Nick Luchterhand ever since.
Because he went to the high school.
Yeah, exactly. He switched when I switched. He started when I started. So I guess kind of a shout out to him, because 6 years of my musical career is just like because of him. But yeah, so I started.
So many good things about him. He's really
incredible. Yeah, so he went to Camby. He was at George Fox. Like, he never left.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So he's really cool. It was really an experience being able to have one teacher throughout your entire like. Student career, I suppose. But yeah, so I started on trumpet. Wasn't really that into it in middle school, honestly. I thought it was going to be easier than art and music classes. But
okay.
then but fair then enough. I get into high school, and suddenly this just drive hits me, and I'm like, this is what I want to do for the rest of my life. I don't know how it happened.
The trumpet.
Yeah. Yeah, specifically trumpet, nothing else ever. No. But
I love trumpet so much. Yeah,
you know. No, but I started getting really into just playing music, reading music. I could consider myself having an affinity for being able to read music and get into rhythms and whatnot. And so I knew early on that I wanted to do something with music, and I feel like education is just one of those things that fits me, which is how I ended up here.
Yeah.
I think I started September of last year, a month before I went back into my second year of college, for music education. So I feel like this place is a really good fit for me. Mm. I love it here, and being able to teach kids is just exactly where I feel like I'm at home.
Yeah.
Teach kids music specifically. So it's been really nice. But yeah, trumpet's my main instrument for sure, but especially after working here, I've kind of picked up a little bit of everything: flute, clarinet, saxophones of multiple sorts,
yeah.
low brass, and I've gotten a little bit into guitar, but I don't have as great of a skill as like Christian or Brian.
Yeah. And it sounds like it's really the lessons and working with the kids that's your passion, not so much sort of the performative aspect.
I don't know. I try to consider it even.
Yeah.
I love performing music myself. There's just something about, especially reading a piece for the first time and performing it with a group. That's where I'm like truly at my happy place. But I also really love applying that onto a community of kids who also wants to learn. So I feel like they're kind of equal puzzle pieces that go together. I don't think one brings more joy than the other, but
is it different at all? And correct me if I'm wrong, but I feel like, not being a musician myself, but a lot of times brass is more, it's not like a solo instrument, right? So it's not like guitar. You could have just one person up there with a guitar
right.
playing
I mean,
a song.
Yeah, like, you totally could. I suppose you could have trumpet solos, obviously, but there's definitely
I
always
feel like
an
I
ensemble.
Wouldn't go to that show.
Yeah, no, just trumpet alone. Yeah. No, I get that. Yeah, it's just one guy standing on stage, and he's just like, yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
No, yeah, brass and woodwind's definitely an ensemble instrument, and so I think part of that is also what I really like, is just being able to
being
build
part of it.
Yeah, it feels like its own little community when you join like a band and kind of start, well, literally and metaphorically harmonizing with each other as people.
Awesome. Do you guys both work with a lot of kids, or with guitar and strings? Christian, you're probably seeing more adults, whereas it's not all, a lot of like 40-year-olds are like, I want to learn the guitar, not necessarily
exactly.
I want to learn the trombone. So.
Yeah, no, exactly. So
it's more band kids.
Yeah. Especially around here, once kids start finding instruments to rent and start doing lessons in that kind of middle school phase, or some kids just want to push an instrument onto their kid and they really want to do something loud.
Yeah.
So trumpet's like, amazing, I can annoy my parents.
Yes. Yeah.
So most of my students are definitely kids, but actually recently I've started to have people, like adults, get lessons for Christmas on instruments that they've always wanted to get around to learning but never could.
Yeah.
Which I think is really cool. I obviously enjoy teaching the kids, but teaching adults is like Yeah, it feels completely different, but it is an interesting experience for sure.
Yeah. You've been here how long, Lana?
Oh, I think 4 months at most. Yeah.
Cool. What do you like about it?
Everything. Yeah. the teaching the lessons, it's just exactly what I want to do, but I don't need a degree for it. And I feel like not having to go through the hardship of a degree has like really made me like want to just like stay here. But you know, just being surrounded by musicians all day, every day has like just really made me feel at peace.
Yeah, very immersive.
Yeah, exactly.
Just, you're literally surrounded by instruments.
Yeah, no, exactly. It's just something that I get to talk about all day, every day without annoying everyone around me.
Yeah.
Also I just get a ton of opportunities here, teaching new people. I get to meet new people who have like, given me offers to like, I don't know, perform with them, just duet with them, do little things with them. And I've also gotten into being able to start repairing, brass and woodwind instruments, which is really nifty because you know, if something breaks, you'll know what happened. You don't have to sit around with a busted instrument until you can take it in.
Right.
But yeah, I don't know. There's just something in my brain that gets the satisfaction from taking apart a clarinet.
Yeah, it is very rewarding.
It's so nice because then it sounds better, it feels better, it looks better. It's shiny, but
absolutely. Cool. Well, thank you guys so much. It's been so great getting to meet you and talk to you a little bit. Anything else that either of you would like to add before we go?
Come in and take some lessons. It's a party over here.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, definitely learn something. Yeah. Instruments are fun. Music is great.
And welcome back to the ad sponsor section, where I get to talk to people about books, because I always drag Megan Waterman in here to be with me. Hi, Megan.
Hi. That's not a bad thing. Talking about books is always the best time.
I think you know of all people that I can talk about books endlessly.
I do.
Yeah. So, Megan, do you want to tell our listeners about what's going on down at the Book Nook?
Oh, at the Book Nook, we are getting ready for the holidays.
Yeah.
I know.
There's only one I care about. And by the time this ad comes out, it's basically over.
Are you talking about Halloween?
Yeah, I like spooky, scary stories.
I know you do. We've got a lot of great spooky, scary stories in right now.
Yeah, yeah.
We do, but spooky, scary stories are also good for Christmas. Do you have a favorite author that writes spooky, scary stories that are appropriate for Christmas?
You go with your classic Charles Dickens, right?
Yep.
Some Christmas Carol stuff.
Absolutely. That's my favorite.
That's the best. There's M.R. James. I know about him. He did a whole series of short scary stories for Christmas.
Short scary stories? I don't know. Christmas in general is kind of scary. It depends on how many people you have to buy for.
How many people you have to cook dinner for?
Right.
Speaking of cooking dinner, Thanksgiving is coming up.
Thanksgiving is coming. We have got some beautiful cookbooks in recently, and some really cute kids cookbooks just came in. If you want to start cooking with your grandkids or starting to teach, train up your little ones to cook Thanksgiving dinner so you can just sit on the couch and watch football.
And right now is the time to go in, right?
Yes.
Because waiting until Christmas Eve for that one special book that someone wants isn't going to work out.
It's not going to be there. This year, it's no secret, the last year and a half has been a little crazy for the whole world. And that is really going to affect Christmas this year. There are going to be serious stock issues this year. So get your Christmas shopping done early. We've been working really hard to get as much inventory on our shelves and in our overstock as possible so that we have what you want at Christmas time. But if you know now a title that you want to buy for somebody for Christmas, get it now.
All right.
I might not be able to get it later.
And what is all three of ours? Because we also have Amy in the studio with us. What's all three of ours this season's book recommendation?
Okay.
Amy, what's your book recommendation for this season?
The Night Before Christmas.
All right. Yeah, that's classic. Megan?
And for me, my favorite Christmas read? Okay, my favorite book that's coming out it's no secret, I am an Outlander fan. I love Diana Gabaldon. There may be a cardboard cutout of Jamie Frazier in our bookstore. Book boyfriends are a thing.
Yeah.
And finally, book 9 is coming out towards the end of November. So you will not see me until I finish reading that.
And mine is the Dungeons & Dragons Feast of Legends or whatever, the table. So make sure you guys come on down to Book Nook. Megan, where are you guys located?
We are on the corner of Grant and 2nd in downtown Canby.
All right.
Now Hear This Canby is produced by me, Tyler Clausen. Our content director and star reporter is Tyler Frankie. And of course, our show is edited by Cameron Clausen. We also feature the vocal talents of Joy Struby and James Walden. So a round of applause to them. The song that you're hearing right now is Canby by singer-songwriter Olivia Harms, used with her permission. To find more work from her, you can visit her website olivia13.com.
Now Hear This Canby is dedicated to preserving independent local journalism and redefining local news with our fun, fresh, and energetic brand of storytelling. Our sincere thanks to our local sponsors who make this show possible. Please show your appreciation by supporting the small businesses who support us.
The production of Now Hear This Studios, Canby's locally owned, full-service audio, video, and media production company. Our mission is to produce the best content in the universe. And we'd love to help you do it. Find us online at nhtstudios.com.
I will take a motion to adjourn.
I just moved it.
I didn't even ask for it, though.
2. And now, a message from Donna Ellison of Ellison Team Homes.
Hi, everyone. I wanted to take this moment to invite you personally to come and hang out with us for our end of season client event. It's a thank you to all the wonderful people we've done business with, as well as a welcome to a lot of our community. I'm doing this in partnership with Vanessa Zimmerman, Zimmerman team at Academy Mortgage. It's just kind of our way of saying thank you. We've really enjoyed getting to know you, doing business with you, etc. We'll be outside. We're sensitive to the fact that we're in COVID, still dealing with that. So it will be spread out. People will have room to breathe and sit and walk and talk. Reckless Company, if you've never heard them before, they're awesome. They're going to be playing. We'll have TMK here. I can't wait to try the corn dog. I've been waiting like 2 years to try this corn dog. So it looks amazing, and I've heard it's amazing, and I think there's quite a following. Also, they'll have all kinds of other food. We'll have beer and cider. Everything's hosted, of course, as a thank you. Again, it's for our clients. It's for our community. We really, really want to come and celebrate. We'll have swag for you, all kinds of fun things for the kids. We hope to see you on 9/16 from 4 to 8 in the afternoon.
Can Be Then is brought to you by Retro Revival. They are not your average antique shop. Open daily. Find them on the corner of Northwest 3rd and Grant in downtown Canby, or connect with them on Facebook or through email at retrorevivaloc@gmail.com. There are countless names and families who stand out in the annals of local history and who helped found Canby and build it into the community it has become over the past nearly 200 years. Ferlander and Anna Lee, whose donation land claim would become the heart of downtown Canby, have obviously earned their place. Big Jim Baker, the wild frontiersman who operated a huge ranch in what is now North Canby in the 1830s, and nearly had the honor of having the town named after him, makes for a colorful tale. Kentuckian Champing Pendleton and family were among the earliest known permanent settlers in the Canby area and would make their mark on the town for decades to come. But perhaps no single person was more instrumental in those very early days than another Kentuckian, Samuel K. Barlow. After all, he built the Barlow Road, the final overland segment of the Oregon Trail, without which the so-called ABC sister cities of Aurora, Barlow, and Canby may not have developed until decades later, if at all. In this latest series of our Canby Then history segment, we'll be looking at the lasting legacy of the Barlow family in our area, not the least of which includes the town of Barlow, Barlow Road, and the gorgeously restored historical treasure, the Barlow House. Samuel Kimbrough Barlow was a trailblazer in every sense of the word, a tailor by trade and training who lived a colorful life. In August 1827, he was convicted of manslaughter for killing a man with an axe the previous October. Sentenced to 1 year of hard labor, his crime was eventually pardoned by the governor of Indiana after scores of people, including the victim's brother, pleaded on his behalf since he had acted only to protect his wife, Susanna Lee, and their six children, Sarah, James, John, Eliza Jane, Eli, and William. In 1845, Barlow and his family joined legendary pioneer and statesman Joel Palmer, who would later serve as an Oregon legislature and Speaker of the House, in his train of 23 covered wagons bound for Oregon. Along the way, the 53-year-old made one of the earliest ascents of Mount Hood, though he did not reach the summit, as he and Palmer were scouting for a crossing. The party had arrived in the Dalles in the fall of 1845 and were told that they would have to wait weeks for passage. Unable to afford the high price of food, and having seen a notch in the south slope of the mighty peak, Barlow declared, and I quote, "God never made a mountain that had no place to go over it or around it," unquote, and headed south to find a way around Mount Hood. On October 7, 1845, Barlow climbed all the way to the 9,000-foot level in order to clear the tree line and find a way off the mountain. The path they ultimately chose would later be known as Barlow Pass, and the party made it through, some on horseback, some barefoot, on moccasins worn nearly to shreds from the long journey, and at least one woman riding atop a cow before the first snows fell that season. 9 years later, Barlow, along with five other men led by Thomas J. Dreyer, made another attempted ascent of Oregon's tallest peak, which some consider the first summiting of Mount Hood, though the report has been disputed. A later climb by a party led by Henry Pittock in 1857 was far better documented and is generally considered the first official ascent to the summit, with Dreyer et al.'s deemed to have fallen a couple hundreds feet short. At any rate, there is no dispute that the Barlows achieved their goal of reaching and establishing a new home in the Oregon country, with their party arriving in the burgeoning Oregon city on Christmas night in 1845. The groups returned for their wagons after the snows melted the following year, and Barlow petitioned the provisional legislature for the right to construct a toll road over the route taken by the party. With a partner, Philip Foster, Barlow began road construction. It was a difficult road to build. There were miles of thickets and dense timber to slash through. There were steep hills and streams to cross. Swamps had to be corduroyed, which was a type of road made by placing logs perpendicular to the direction of the road over a low or swampy area. Barlow asked for $4,000 to construct the road, having estimated a rate of $50 a mile. But even in those days, this proved inadequate, and supplies had to be bought on credit. By August 1846, the road was ready for travel. Most Barlow Road travelers shared a similar experience. If possible, they camped overnight at Gate Creek or Tide Valley, resting their livestock for the trial ahead and lightening their loads by abandoning any unneeded items. Early the next day, they set out for a long drive up the eastern slopes of the Cascades to reach White River, where they camped along the western bank below the mouth of Barlow Creek. If all went well, the next day they advanced to the upper reaches of Barlow Creek and camped in the deep forest east of Barlow Pass. After about 1860, a forest fire in that area created what emigrants called the Deadening, and later, the Devil's Half Acre. The third day, travelers pressed over Barlow Pass and descended to Summit Meadow. By then, their livestock were desperately hungry, but could only find sour sedges or dry willow and alder limbs to nibble on. The fourth day was a brutal slog, the transit of the boggy lower slopes of Mount Hood, where, in 1849, The United States Army's mounted riflemen were compelled to abandon their heavily loaded wagons and cache military supplies at what later became known as Government Camp. If a slow wagon got in the way, or if oxen died, as was sometimes the case, travelers might be caught on the one-way trace on Laurel Hill and have to spend the night, literally, in the middle of the road. But if they were luckier, they made the difficult descent of Laurel Hill and passed down the zigzag drainage to camp at a small clearing near present-day Rhododendron. The penultimate day involved a long drive, but the road was usually in good shape. At the Sandy River, they forded to the north bank, passed through heavily forested Mensinger Bottom, ascended the Devil's Backbone, and pushed on to the second Sandy River crossing. And on the sixth day, provided all had gone well, they ascended the hillside to present Sandy and drove on to Philip Foster's farm at Eagle Creek. The Barlow Row was not only the final leg of the Oregon Trail for most settlers, it was also the only stretch on the 2,100-mile trail where tolls were charged. Five toll gates were eventually established along the route of the Barlow Road from Tyke Valley to the Sandy River between 1846 and 1918. The tolls ended when the last owners deeded to the road to the state of Oregon. For 2 years following the construction, Captain Barlow personally collected the toll. In 1846, according to his report, quote, 145 wagons, 1,559 head of horses, mules and horned cattle, and one drum of sheep, unquote, passed through the toll gates. A portage operation along the Oregon shore from the Upper Cascades to the mouth of Tanner Creek, established by Joseph Ruckel and Harrison Olmsted in 1855, along with a warehouse to serve steamboats in those months when vessels could ascend beyond the upper end of Bradford Island, competed with the Barlow Road. 5 years later, the Oregon Steam Navigation Company took over the Ruckel and Olmsted line, consolidating portage interests in the gorge and emerging during the Civil War as the region's transportation monopoly. The discovery of gold in Idaho and Montana in 1862 and the rushes to that region fueled the flow of goods and passengers and confirmed the value of the company's investments. When the road opened in 1846, tolls were $5 per wagon and 10 cents for every head of livestock. $5 was about 1 week's wages in those days, but the alternative, floating down the Columbia River in boats or rafts, or later, paying the exorbitant fees charged by the OSN, cost at least 10 times that amount. Thus, the Barlow Road became the poor man's route, an arduous, time-consuming, but cheaper alternative to the Columbia Gorge. You've now made it to the end of your own long journey, namely the first in our two-part series on the legacy of Sam Barlow and his family. We have much more to tell you about their exploits and accomplishments, but we'll have to wait until next time on Can Be Then.
Now Hear This Can Be is produced by me, Tyler Clausen. Our content director and star reporter is Tyler Frankie. And of course, our show is edited by Cameron Clausen. We also feature the vocal talents of Joy Struby and James Walden. So a round of applause to them. The song that you're hearing right now is Can Be by singer-songwriter Olivia Harms, used with her permission. To find more work from her, you can visit her website, olivia13.com.
Now Hear This Can Be is dedicated to preserving independent local journalism and redefining local news with our fun, fresh, and energetic brand of storytelling. Our sincere thanks to our local sponsors who make this show possible. Please show your appreciation by supporting the small businesses who support us.
The production of Now Hear This Studios, Canby's locally owned, full-service audio, video, and media production company. Our mission is to produce the best content in the universe. And we'd love to help you do it. Find us online at nhtstudios.com.
I will take a motion to adjourn.
I just moved it.
I didn't even ask for it, though.
Tyler, did you know that the Australian lyrebird can mimic any sound that it hears? even chainsaws?
No, that's super interesting.
Did you know that a baby puffin is called a puffling? Or no. That baby sea otters can't swim, so their moms wrap them up in pieces of kelp until they learn how to paddle.
Wait, do you know any trivia that isn't like animal related?
Not really, but here's some stuff you may not know about the Wild Hare Saloon, where Camby goes to eat and have fun.
Okay.
The Wild Hare is one of Camby's longest running locally owned restaurants. Owners Joan and Darren Moden have been in business for 16 years.
That's cool.
Yep. Heck, you were just a baby back then. And they love to give back. They've been members of the Camby Chamber for that long, and they donate over $20,000 to local sports, FFA programs, and civic organizations each year.
Wow, I'm legitimately like caught off. That's cool.
Yeah. They also support more than 30 jobs in the community through their award-winning staff, some of them as young as 18. Hey, that's older than you are.
Dude, I'm 10 months younger than you.
With the days getting longer and the weather getting warmer, the Camby Wild Hare's expansive outdoor patio is the place to be. Furry friends, welcome.
Well, that sounds great. I'm going to go check them out just off of Highway 99E next to the Space Age in Camby at 1656 Beaver Creek Road in Oregon City, or on their website at thewildhairsaloon.net.